It is a moment that we have anticipated from the beginning of the story. We were told that the seed of the woman would crush the head of the serpent, but his heel would be struck in the process. Satan's work would be undone, but not without cost. And now, after thousands of years, history has finally caught up with prophecy. And the narrative has begun to feel like that split second of a car crash. And time is slowing down. Matthew devotes 33% of his gospel to the final week of Jesus' life. Mark, 37%. Luke, 25%. And John devotes almost half of his gospel to those final 7 days at 42%. Why is so much attention given to the events surrounding Jesus' death? That's because the cross was the crucial moment in history. It's the climax of the story. It's the place where both sides, the hero and the villain, they come and they put all of their chips on the table. It is winner takes all. And Jesus came to win. Now, if victory or defeat is sealed at the cross, do you think that Satan is just going to sit this one out? Do you think he's going to go away quietly or call in sick? Pick it up where we left off last week. Matthew chapter 27. We're going to start in verse 27. Matthew 27, verse 27. The soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the praetorium, and they gathered the whole Roman cohort around him. They stripped him, and they put a scarlet robe on him. And after twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on his head and a reed in his right hand. And they knelt before him and mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they spat on him. And they took the reed and began to beat him on the head. The prophet Isaiah describes the Messiah as one whose appearance was marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men, likely referencing the abuse that he's receiving from the Romans that would leave him disfigured to the point where he was practically unrecognizable. The Roman soldiers, they were generally free to abuse prisoners bound for execution. These men were dead men walking, so they had free range to do whatever they wanted to them. It didn't matter, they were going to die anyway. And as we see here, they could become very creative with their cruelty. We find the charge for Jesus in verse 37. The charge that they're going to place on the head of his cross was, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Jesus is being executed for being a king, for being a rival to Caesar. That's who the Christ is. He is the King of the Jews. It's a fact that's overlooked by many Christians today. But it wasn't overlooked by the Romans. They specifically mocked him and dressed him up in a monstrous costume, complete with a crown made of thorns. Now, you'd have to be a pretty sadistic person to come up with a torture device like that. But as if that wasn't enough, pressing this torture device into his scalp, they took a reed and they began to beat it into his skull. It's evident by the time that he left this beating that he had been wounded so badly, he had been scourged so severely, he had lost so much blood that he wasn't able to carry on with his crossbeam. They had to find someone else to help him to the place that they were going to nail him up. Notice it. Verse 31. After they had mocked him, they took the scarlet robe off him, they put on his own garments, and they led him away to crucify him. And as they were coming out, they found a man of Cyrene named Simon, whom they pressed into service to bear his cross. And when they came to a place called Golgotha, which means place of the skull, they gave him wine to drink, mixed with gall. And after tasting it, he was unwilling to drink. And when they had crucified him, they divided up his garments among themselves by casting lots. And sitting down, they began to keep watch over him there. And above his head they put the charge against him, which read, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." The honor of bearing our Lord's cross goes to a man from North Africa who just happened to be in the line of sight of the Roman soldiers that day. Now, if a Roman soldier came by and he enlisted you to aid him, if you were conscripted for a service, you didn't really have an opportunity to protest. His choice was either A, you can carry Jesus' beam to Jesus' execution, or you can carry B, his own beam to his own execution. He chose the former. And the event seems to have made an impression on him. It may have led to his conversion, as Mark includes the names of his sons, Alexander and Rufus. So they seem to be prominent people in the Christian community that would have been known. Simon takes his cross and he goes with Jesus. They're led to a place called Golgotha, the place of the skull. We sometimes call this place Calvary, not to be confused with cavalry. Jesus was not crucified on cavalry, on horseback. He was crucified on Calvary, which comes from the Latin word calvaria, which means skull. It means cranium. I think of that old hymn, "Years I spent of vanity and pride, caring not my Lord was crucified, knowing not it was for me he died on Calvary." On the way there, I think we begin to see Satan make his first move. Notice at verse 34, they give him wine to drink mixed with gall. And after tasting it, he was unwilling to drink. Gall is just a word for a bitter substance. It is a something that tastes terrible. Mark identifies the actual substance. It's myrrh. Myrrh, like we remember at Jesus' birth. It was one of the precious things that the wise men brought because it can be used in perfume. But it can also be used as a narcotic, as something to dull the senses, something to relieve the pain. And he's certainly experiencing a lot of pain, and it's about to get 10 times worse. Now I look at this and I ask, why would the cruel Roman soldiers allow Jesus to be given such a cocktail? I mean, they want him to suffer, don't they? Well, there's a couple reasons I can think of. One, a stupefied prisoner is going to be a lot easier to nail to a piece of wood. And secondly, a stupefied prisoner is going to die a lot more quickly. And if you're a Roman soldier, you're out there until the end of the job. You're there until he dies. This was not an act of mercy on the Roman soldier's part. It's an act of expedience. We want to get home. And the sooner this guy dies, which could take days, the sooner we can leave. I think of this scene. I don't know if any have y'all ever seen the movie Braveheart, that old movie? Mel Gibson. I think of William Wallace, and he's awaiting his own pretty terrible form of execution, drawn and quartering. And someone comes in and they manage to give him a vial of a substance that's supposed to dull the senses. And he puts it in his mouth, and then he spits it out. I remember watching that and thinking, why would you do that? Are you crazy? You're about to be cut up. Why are you going to spit this out? Well, that's what Jesus does. Now I look at this and I ask, why? Why would Jesus deny himself a drink that would ease his suffering? Well, because it's the Father's will that he would suffer for the sin of the world. You may recall, though, we saw a very similar temptation as this way back at the beginning of Matthew, at least. Chapter 4. Jesus is led by the Spirit into the wilderness, according to the will of the Father, by the way. And he becomes hungry after 40 days. And guess who shows up? It's the serpent. And he has a temptation. If you are the Son of God, turn these stones to bread. You're in the wilderness, Jesus. Ain't no food around. Ain't no water around. You don't have to be hungry. You don't have to suffer. Here, Satan seems to be barking up the same tree through his children. You can go to the cross, Jesus. You can die. You don't have to suffer, though. You can be a Savior without suffering, Jesus. Jesus says no. He refuses. And according to Mark here, it is 9 a.m. on Friday morning. They nail him to the cross. And the only fitting word to describe what Jesus would experience during the hours is a word that we created specifically to refer to this brutal form of execution. Do you know the word? Excruciating. Excruciating. It is a term that ultimately derives from the Latin cruciare, which means to crucify. And let that sink in for a moment. For the next 6 hours, Jesus would endure an execution so agonizing, we had to create a new vocabulary to accommodate the suffering that's going to be involved. In his book, The Life of Christ, Frederick Farrar has this to say about crucifixion. One thing is clear. The first century executions were not like the modern ones, for they did not seek quick, painless death, nor the preservation of any measure of dignity for the criminal. On the contrary, they sought an agonizing torture which completely humiliated him. And it is important that we understand this, for it will help us realize the agony of Christ's death. A death by crucifixion seems to include all that pain and death can have for the horrible and the ghastly. Dizziness, cramp, thirst, starvation, sleeplessness, traumatic fever, shame, publicity of shame, long continuous torment, horror of anticipation, mortification of intended wounds, all intensified just up to the point which they can be endured at all, but stopping just short of the point which would give the sufferer the relief of unconsciousness. Dr. Truman Davis, looking at the crucifixion of Jesus from a medical point of view, adds, "As the arms fatigue, great waves of cramp sweep over the muscles, knotting them into deep, relentless, throbbing pain. With these cramps comes the inability to push himself upward. Hanging by his arms, the pectoral muscles are paralyzed and the intercostal muscles are unable to act. Air can be drawn into the lungs, but it cannot be exhaled. Jesus fights to raise himself up in order to get even one short breath. And finally, carbon dioxide builds up in the lungs and in the bloodstream, and the cramps partially subside. Spasmodically, he's able to push himself upward to exhale and bring that life-giving oxygen. Hours of limitless pain. Cycles of twisting, joint-rending cramps. Intermittent partial asphyxiation, searing pain as tissue is torn from his lacerated back as he moves up and down against the rough timber. And then another agony begins. A deep crushing pain in the chest as the pericardium slowly fills with serum and begins to compress the heart. And it's almost done now. The compressed heart is struggling to pump heavy, thick, sluggish blood into the tissues, and the tortured lungs begin making frantic effort to gasp even small gulps of air. Now, of course, Jesus would have been well acquainted with all of this ahead of time. This wouldn't have been his first rodeo. Crucifixion was one of the Romans' favorite method of execution. They executed over 30,000 Jews in Palestine. He would have known all about what leads up to it, all about what it involved. I think of birth videos. My wife, we had some friends over this week, and one of them is expecting, and for whatever reason, she was telling my wife, she was going around watching birth videos. I said, you don't want to do that. It's not going to make it any better. Sometimes ignorance is bliss, because the anticipation, the anxiety of expectation of the pain and suffering that is involved in this traumatic event. And even so, Jesus chooses to suffer. Verse 38. At that time, two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and one on the left. And those passing by were hurling abuse at him, wagging their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. "If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." As if the ridicule and abuse from the crowd wasn't enough, even the prisoners suffering the same fate begin hurling insults at him. And it's here, I think we can see, the adversary makes his second attempt. Notice his attack through his seed, verse 40. "If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." If you are the Son of God. Now that's a very familiar question. It only appears in one other place in Matthew. It's Matthew chapter 4, the temptation. You might recall, the serpent approaches Jesus, and in his second temptation to the Christ, he takes him to the pinnacle of a temple, of the temple in Jerusalem. And he says, "If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down. Make a mighty display so that the people will believe." Now, he was trying to get Jesus to kill himself or to force the Father's hand to go against the Father's will. Now things have changed. Now the seed of the serpent say, "Well, you who spoke of destroying and rebuilding the temple, if you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. Make a mighty display. Show yourself to us. Save yourself." What are they saying? "Don't die. If you're the Son of God, don't die." Which may have been very tempting for Jesus. A Christ without a cross? But the religious leaders make an even more enticing offer. Notice it. Verse 41. "In the same way, the chief priests also, along with the scribes and the elders, were mocking him. And they were saying, 'He saved others. He cannot save himself. He is the King of Israel. Let him now come down from the cross and we will believe him. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he delights in him. For he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" And the robbers who had been crucified with him were also insulting him with these same words. As you read the third temptation in Matthew, what was Satan's offer? Do you recall it? "All the kingdoms in the world, Jesus, I will give to you. You can have it without dying. All you have to do is submit to me. Bow down to me. Submit to me instead of the Father, and I can give you everything because it belongs to me." And that's what you really want, isn't it, Jesus? You really want the kingdom. You can have it without dying. The kingdom now is in a state of delay. It's been postponed. Jesus' desire is delayed. And why? Because the religious rulers rejected him. Because they're on Satan's team. Here, what are they saying? "Jesus, if you just come down from the cross, we'll believe. We'll believe. We'll believe and we will follow you into the kingdom. Submit to our desire. We'll submit to your desires." Now, this is one of 1,000 reasons why I would have failed where Jesus succeeded. Because I would come down off that cross and I'd have wiped them all out. Said, "Granted." And I'd have put them in the grave. But not Jesus. He endures. He suffers. And the Lord of life chooses to die. He accepts the blow on the heel in order to crush the head of the serpent. And now something very interesting begins to happen. Notice it. Verse 45. "Now from the sixth hour, darkness fell upon all the land until the ninth hour. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, 'Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani?' That is, 'My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?' And some of those who were standing there, when they heard it, began saying, 'This man is calling for Elijah.' And immediately one of them ran, and taking a sponge, he filled it with sour wine and put it on a reed and gave him a drink. But the rest of them said, 'Let us see whether Elijah will come to save him.'" 3 hours pass, and at noon, during what would be normally the brightest period of the day, the sky goes dark. And it remains dark for a full 3 hours. And at 3 p.m., after 6 hours of agony and insult, Jesus opens his mouth to speak. And he is clearly having difficulty talking at this point, which, combined with their taunts, is why some of them think he may be calling for Elijah. He's trying to enlist divine aid, divine deliverance. And they rush him to give him something to wet his parched throat so that they have the ability to hear him better. But the statement that he made was, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" I look at this and I ask, what on earth is going on here? Has Satan finally gotten to Jesus? Has a problem arisen in the divine plan? Has a seed of doubt begun to germinate in the heart of our Savior? One explanation that some have offered is that when darkness came at noon, Jesus became sin and consequently suffered spiritual separation from the Father. I think of Stuart Townend's song, "How Deep the Father's Love for Us." You know, how deep the Father's love for us, how vast beyond all measure, that He would give His only Son to make a wretch His treasure. How great the pain of searing loss, the Father turns His face away, as wounds which mar the chosen one bring many sons to glory. Is that what took place? Did the Father turn His face away? This is a view held by many great theologians from past and present. I think of that and I ask, is that even possible? Is that right? Did Christ's death on the cross create a rift in the Trinity? Did the Father turn His face away? Or is something else going on here? Has Satan gotten to Jesus? Has the adversary gained a foothold? One thing that all can agree on is that Jesus is quoting Psalm 22, verse 1. And the question is, what on earth is He doing with that text? And as we've mentioned in the past, usually when a verse gets quoted in the New Testament, the author isn't just picking a sentence from the Old Testament and saying, "I like that sentence, I'm going to repurpose it for something else over here." That's not why we quote things. When you're reading a book and somebody quotes something, or you're having a discussion with somebody and somebody quotes something, you're not just telling them the line, you're bringing in the context. You're bringing in the whole passage. And I think that that's what Jesus is doing here. But what would that mean? Why is Jesus quoting Psalm 22? Well, let's turn and look at it and find out together. Psalm 22, and let's start off with verse 1. "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me? Far from my deliverance are the words of my groaning. Oh my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night, but I have no rest. Yet you are holy. Oh, you who are enthroned upon the praises of Israel, in you our fathers trusted. They trusted and you delivered them. To you they cried and were delivered. In you they trusted and were not disappointed. But I am a worm and not a man, a reproach of men and despised by the people. All who see me sneer at me. They separate the lip and they wag the head." Who was doing that? Did somebody separate the lip and wag the head? The crowds. The robbers. He goes on. "Commit yourself to the Lord. Let Him deliver him. Let Him rescue him, because He delights in him." That's what they're saying. Who was saying that? The elders. The chief priests. Verse 9. "Yet you are He who brought me forth from the womb. You made me trust when upon my mother's breast, upon you I was cast from birth. You have been my God from my mother's womb." Be not far from me, for trouble is near. For there is none to help. Many bulls have surrounded me. Strong bulls of Bashan have encircled me. They open wide their mouth at me as a ravening and roaring lion. I am poured out like water. All my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted within me. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue cleaves to my jaws. And you lay me in the dust of death. For dogs have surrounded me. A band of evildoers has encompassed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. Interestingly, in Matthew, Jesus is being crucified. This is a detailed description of crucifixion. But crucifixion wasn't invented for at least 600 to 700 years after this. But this is what's going on. Notice it, verse 17. I can count all my bones. They look, they stare at me. They divide my garments among them. And for my clothing, they cast lots. Who was doing that? The Roman soldiers. Has the Father hidden his face? Notice it. But you, O Lord, be not far off. O you, my help, hasten to my assistance. Deliver my soul from the sword, my only life from the power of the dog. Save me from the lion's mouth, from the horns of the wild oxen. You answer me. I will tell of your name to my brethren in the midst of the assembly. I will praise you. You who fear the Lord, praise him. All you descendants of Jacob, glorify him, and stand in awe of him, all of you descendants of Israel. For he has not despised nor abhorred the affliction of the afflicted, nor has he hidden his face from him. But when he cried to him for help, he heard. Has the Father hidden his face from his Son? He has not. From you comes my praise in the great assembly. I shall pay my vows before those who fear him. The afflicted will eat and be satisfied. Those who seek him will praise the Lord. Let your heart live forever. All the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord. All the families of the nation will worship before you. For the kingdom is the Lord's, and he rules over the nations. All the prosperous of the earth will eat and worship. All those who go down to the dust will bow down before him, even he who cannot keep his soul alive. Those who go down to the dust will bow down? How? Resurrection. Posterity will serve him. It will be told of the Lord to the coming generation. They will come and declare his righteousness to a people who will be born, that he has performed it. Why is Jesus quoting this psalm? Is he saying the Father is hidden from him? No. What is he saying? Jesus is declaring to all the people around him, he's drawing attention to the fact that this is happening right now. Psalm 22 is being fulfilled before their very eyes. At least the first half of it. You know what's coming in the second half. The king's rule, resurrection. And now the question is, why? Why make this statement? If the Father hasn't hidden his face from the Son, what is going on? Why is Jesus suffering? What is happening? What is the penalty for sin? Death. What is Jesus suffering? Jesus is suffering the wrath of God in an unjust death at the hands of sinners for the sin of the world to conquer the serpent. That's what's going on. A 1,000-year-old prophecy is taking place right around the people. But they're too excited about the death of the King of Glory to listen. Turn back to Matthew. Pick it back up in verse 50. And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. And behold, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth shook and the rocks were split. and the tombs opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they entered the holy city and appeared to many. I love that even in death, Jesus is in complete control. Matthew says, verse 50, he yielded up his spirit. When he had accomplished his purpose, when he had had victory over sin and victory over that serpent when they were defeated, he does not putter out and die. He yields up his spirit. He's done. It's finished. He can go on. And when he does, this whole place starts coming apart at the seams, literally. The veil of the temple is torn in two from top to bottom. And in case you didn't know, that sucker was about 60 feet tall. This wasn't like a little veil like I have right behind me here. The temple was taller, actually, than even Solomon's temple. Solomon's temple was 30 cubits. Herod extended it another 10, 40 cubits, which means about 60 feet tall. This thing went from the floor to the ceiling. So you have this massive curtain. It was probably about 4 inches thick, which you imagine it has to be at least that much. Otherwise, just the sheer weight of this thing would cause it to shred, pulling against itself. It rips from the top to the bottom. This was the veil that separated the holy place from the Holy of Holies. It was what prohibited access, direct access to God, except for on the one day a year, the Day of Atonement. The rending of the veil is signifying that Jesus' sacrifice is sufficient. It is a sufficient atonement for sin. And now entrance into the Holy of Holies, now communion with God, is available to all people for the rest of time. But that's not all. Even the earth, which is groaning, waiting for redemption, cannot help but cry out, and it shakes. Bodies are thrown out of the tomb. The dead are resuscitated. The resurrection is future, but it's like they just can't help it. And it's enough to even cause the Roman soldiers to have a come to Jesus moment. Notice at 54, now the centurion and those who were with him keeping guard over Jesus, when they saw the earthquake and the things that were happening, which are some really crazy things, became very frightened and said, truly this was the Son of God. That disfigured man that you were beating over the head with a rod just 6 hours ago, truly was the Son of God. I don't know if any of you guys have heard of that show, Undercover Boss. You know, they have like the CEO or the head of the company come in like he's some new worker, and they put him in to learn the job, and he's working amongst the people that are at the bottom tier of the company. And then there's a reveal in the end, and surprise, this guy that you've been working with was actually your boss. He's the one that owns this company. Now I imagine, and sometimes it does go this way, because you know, you got rotten coworkers and you got good coworkers. Sometimes there's people that want to help you out and do your job for you. Sometimes there's people that want to make your job miserable. And I think of that feeling that some of them experience, that kind of sinking in the pit of their stomach that's written all over their face when they realize that this person that they've been mistreating actually holds their livelihood in the palm of their hand. You know, your earthly boss is here. And I think, well, if the undercover boss is the King of Eternity, who holds your eternal soul in the palm of his hand, you take that sinking feeling in the pit of your stomach after you've been insulting him, deriding him, rejecting him, multiply it by infinity. Here he is, the undercover king, the Son of God, and you just crucified him. But it was all part of the plan. And Jesus willingly went along. It was the crucial moment in history that everything has been leading up to. With his death on the cross, Jesus' work was finished. With his death on the cross, Satan's days were numbered. Now, what about us? The death of Jesus speaks of how free grace is. in the midst of how costly grace was. Salvation is free for us because it was costly for him. Some people will die in their sins. Why? Because they reject. Some people will die forgiven of their sins. Why? Because they respond. And that is only possible because one man died without sin, so that sinners can spend eternity with him. That's our King. And he's coming again.